Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 550. It's Wednesday, July 23rd, and it's preview night at Comic-Con. I'm going to be missing that tonight. I'm not heading out till tomorrow because we're shooting at midnight tonight with Jonah Kamel and Emily, because tonight The Meltdown premieres on Comedy Central. The Meltdown is basically the show that's shot at the Nerdist showroom at Meltdown Comics every Wednesday, and they shot it there. The show looks fantastic. I did one of the episodes too, but there's bunch of comics that are relevant to your interests. So tonight, Comedy Central, 12:30, after you see Jonah Kamel and Emily on at midnight on Comedy Central. I'm so excited for those guys. So you should watch that show. I think they did maybe 10 episodes for the next 10 Wednesdays. Then we're heading to Comic-Con where we're doing... So here's just a quick rundown of all the places that I'll be at Comic-Con. So Friday at noon, I'm moderating the Walking Dead panel, of course. That panel is going to be fun because we're going to show a bunch of cool stuff this year. Then we are doing, Nerdist is doing laser tag at Petco Park, so you should go check that out as well. Then the Friday night, we're doing an At Midnight Live at the Balboa Theater. Then Saturday, I'm doing the Warner Brothers panel in the morning at Hall H. Then there's a Nerdist panel at 2:30 in the Indigo Ballroom. And then the Marvel panel in the early evening in Hall H I'm doing. And then two Nerdist podcasts live. The 10:30 show, our guest is CM Punk. That show sold out. 7:30 show, there's still tickets. It's Michael Rooker and Evangeline Lilly. Then on Sunday, I'm doing the Sesame Street panel, which I am so excited about. I'm pretty excited about that one. I'm excited about all of them, but that request came out of nowhere, and I could not respond yes fast enough. So that's Sunday morning in room 6A. And then at 12:30, we're doing a Sanjay and Craig panel. We're going to do a couple of live readings of Sanjay and Craig episodes. So very excited about Comic-Con. Again, it's going to be a... I don't know how social I'm going to get to be, but it doesn't matter because I'm doing a lot of cool stuff. So go to Nerdist.com or on the tweets, I'll kind of keep updated like what's what. But have a great con if you're going, which is Guillermo del Toro, who's like the greatest guy in the world. Oh, man. Seriously, if you ever get a chance to sit down and have a conversation with Guillermo, you should absolutely do it. I mean, with his permission, of course. I wouldn't try to force him into a conversation, but he's such a sweet guy that I wanted the podcast to go longer, but I ended up I had to go to a movie screening of Guardians of the Galaxy, which is amazing. You should definitely see Guardians of the Galaxy if you get a chance. That's awesome too. But Guillermo is promoting Crimson Peak and also The Book of Life, which looks stunning, and the TV show The Strain, which is on FX. So that's it. Crimson Peak, Book of Life, The Strain, Guillermo del Toro, Nerdist Podcast, number 550. Start the thing!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Did you see Jodorowsky's Dune
yet? Yeah, I saw it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thank you.
But everyone's
going to
go crazy for it.
Yeah, it's I know a lot of the people behind the scenes.
Sure. Yeah, you're right.
So I know a third version of that story.
Oh, no.
It's a little harder to say, oh, it's exactly
yeah,
what
happened.
Yeah. But it's fascinating, eh?
Yeah. I just like, you know, I like those movies of, like, about people trying. It's like, what was the Loss of La Mancha?
Oh my god, you ever
see that one?
Oh, the Terry Gilliam?
Yeah.
Think about.
Yeah, like just like those things of like people just trying so hard to do something like special and then just getting, you know, circumstances out of their control.
I say this all the time. It's a wonder to me that movies ever get made because there's so many fail points where it could just like, oh, that got fucked up or that got fucked up.
I've come to the maxim and I believe it fully that the natural state of a movie is not getting made. that is natural.
You're not wrong.
More movies will not get made
than they will ever get made. Yeah, it's almost like nitroglycerin is not nitro and glycerin. It's like, the natural state of it is just.
But at what point in a process do you just go, well, I guess this just isn't going to work. Shut this
down.
Never.
Until it happens or not, you know?
Well, yeah.
What have you been sitting on the longest?
Oh, my God. Well, there's some of them actually age.
Yeah.
You know, like I have projects that are 20 years old.
Wow.
That I cannot do anymore because I'm not that guy anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like you go, It's almost like when you find that haiku poem, that mixtape you did in high school.
Yeah.
You go, really? Yeah. I did Nazareth and Neil Diamond. Yeah.
Just Neil Diamond.
Are we on?
Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, when did we start?
I don't know, a couple minutes ago.
As soon as he walked in the room.
But I also think that it works in the reverse, where sometimes you'll have ideas, but you're too young to make them, and then you get to a certain point where they make more sense to you.
That has happened to me, and then they don't get made. Yeah. Like it happened, like one of the oldest is Monte Cristo, mm-hmm. which is a gothic Western version of the Count of Monte Cristo. I wrote it, I was daunted by it, then I felt I'm ready to do it, I couldn't do it. I mean, and like a fisherman, you know, every filmmaker, the greatest one is the ones that get away, you know? You go like, oh, you should have seen that fantastic fish, it was amazing, you know?
But are you good at being zen about it and going, well, I guess this didn't get made for a reason, or no. Do you still go, God damn it?
No, I feel gutted and horrified. It's like, I mean, you cannot really take it easy. You can take it with some philosophy and you can say, look, this truly, truly can't happen. When you let go, which is rare, you know, is when you really go, your heart, your mind, your gut say, it's not going to happen. But normally it just happens with time. And you drag those projects like the dead donkeys in Buñuel's, the donkeys on the piano that the guy is dragging through the ground, you know. They weigh very, the ones that don't get made weigh heavier on you than the ones you make.
Oh, wow. Mm. Yeah, because I guess the ones you make, you get to express and they're out there and then it just gets out of your system. But those
look at it. If you're a painter and you never sell a painting in your life, you still have the hope of after 20 years after you die, someone will find an attic and go, If you're a poet, same thing. If you're a filmmaker, you're not going to go. Somebody's going to open a closet and go, wow, there are all these giant movies that nobody ever saw, you know?
Just reels of film. This guy must have shot everything.
And they're all just Glenn or Glenda. That's when you find stuff.
Well, the beauty of that biography is that Ed Wood's widow, and I found it really moving, is after he passed, they interviewed her for one of the obituaries. And she said, with absolute conviction and great emotion, the world has lost a genius. And you can absolutely see that being a true statement, and how in their relationship and the marriage, we all kind of live in that bubble, right? I mean, to some degree.
I mean, I think you have to. There's when you're in a relationship, you kind of have to celebrate their stuff.
Absolutely.
And you become like, you know, you have to. And that's why you see couples that are like, that couple's crazy. Like, they're both crazy because they live in that bubble of reality.
That's a blessing.
You can just say Randy Quaid. It's fine.
What was it? The star fucker? Was it the Hollywood star killer?
I just remember him coming in right when that was happening. He came into the Apple store when I was working there to have me erase his computer.
Oh, wow.
Like, with a real crazed look in his eyes. And I was like, no problem, Randy
Quaid. So you backed it up on a flash drive somewhere, right? And then erased it?
Yeah, he put out a single. It was the worst song, all about how everyone's trying to kill celebrities.
Man,
Star Whackers. That was
Star Whackers.
Yeah, and it's like kind of like this real jaunty punk song. And it's completely, obviously, Randy Quaid just coked up and is in, the Star Whackers! Yeah. They're coming to get you!
Canada's own, Randy Quaid.
So how many projects do you have bouncing around at various stages right now?
Well, the reality is that I have the ones that are active, real active, and as soon as they become real and they're going to happen, you commit to them. And the ones that you're developing, and developing means... can mean you have a writer working on it. You have a writer working on it. You are designing. You designed it. I mean, it means it's so. So when you have a list, it's truly something like a rosary of some things that are active and others are not. It's the stations of the cross.
But the
funny thing is, everybody really operates that way. I'm for whatever reason, mine become public.
Yeah.
You know, but it's you know, you have to know that out of 5 things you have, or more, out of 10 things you have, one is going to hit. One is going to really get made. And sometimes the most unexpected one is the one that happens.
But it's such a – with film, there's such a – you have to be so patient because it's such a shitty long process.
It is.
That you can't – it's sort of, you know – that's why it's fun to make stuff on the internet. Like, hey, you want to shoot a thing? Great. We shot it. Okay, done. We just put it up tonight. You know, even with television, it'll take like a year or two to get something on the air. But movies, like you said, 20 years, 5, 10 years is not really an uncommon.
No, it's not uncommon. I mean, when you think about it, Crimson Peak, for example, which I finished, it took 8 years.
Wow.
Devil's Backbone, 13. And you keep going, Kronos, 8 or 9, you know, and it is not uncommon. And then the day comes when you shoot the scene. Like I remember in Kronos, I wrote a scene that was my favorite scene in the movie, and it's not in the film. And I came home that night to my wife, and I started just getting nuts. And she said, "What happened?" And she says, "I just shot the scene that I dreamt for the longest, and I ruined it.
Oh,
it's not going to work. And I don't have the money, nor the time, nor a strategy to reshoot it." So I knew it was lost.
Well, first of all, what scene was it and how did you ruin it?
It was a scene. It was the first day we were trying the makeup effects on the actor. And the shade of color was too pink. I knew it when he entered the set and he got the blue light on his face. It popped. And I said, it's going to look terrible. I cannot use it. But the scene was when, I don't know if you remember the movie, but the undead guy, the vampire, Jesus Gray, comes back and tries to touch his wife, tries to caress her face, and he can't, because for her, he's dead. So he cannot wake her up, he cannot talk to her, so he falls asleep in the rug next to the bed and leaves at dawn. And he does that every night. And I found it very touching, very beautiful, but it was pink. and I knew we couldn't go back. The makeup was the first time they applied it. They went 4 hours over time.
Oh, wow.
And it was a disaster.
And so how do you...
You live with it.
You do have to live with it, right?
Well, you live with it because then you know, the scene that you thought you were going to shoot in a hurry becomes great. And the thing, it happens, it just... when it's sort of part of the material that molds the movie is the unexpected, and it really you can be fascinated endlessly by the making of, and people can talk about endlessly about the storyboarding. But the real fascinating factor for me is the unexpected, when the ray of light hit the wrong way and it hit somebody in the face and it lit it. That's the real magic of film, when you capture the things that you didn't expect it, they were going
to
happen.
But you have to be not rigid. You have to be open to seeing, like some people maybe aren't necessarily as flexible, right? Mm-hmm. Because it all has to be this exact way.
Well, I think you prepare a lot. You prepare obsessively in order to be open to the unexpected.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really what you... Ultimately, you go in with a battle plan, at least I do, and you go in, you know exactly what you want, and then if something different happens, you recognize it. But it comes with time, I think. Other people go in and they literally say, let's see what happens. You know, and they can spend the whole morning rehearsing, and then they go, let's do it this way. And that's another valid way of working.
How do you work before? Like, do you have the actors rehearse a lot before you go in to shoot, or do you?
Depends on the scene. Like, for example, if it's a very, very tense or delicate scene, I show up one hour before them. They show up an hour or two before the crew. I've been there now 1 hour. Mm-hmm. I'm 3 hours before anyone is there, and I rehearse with them without anyone there. Not even the AD, not even the cinematographer, sometimes the cinematographer and the AD. I see them do it. We exchange, what if we do it this way? Well, and then I revise my storyboards according to what happened on that rehearsal.
Oh, wow.
That's the best. Yeah, yeah. Or you, if the actors are there for weeks, you can do it in advance. And depends on the movie. You know, some movies you only build a third of a set.
Right.
So you cannot say, let's go over here. Yeah. You don't have the rest of the set. Yeah.
Right. And then with Pac Rim, mm-hmm. what was that like going into when you first started shooting? Were you, I mean, everything I would imagine at that point, because there's so much,
yes.
Everything's on such a large scale that you have to have everything really locked down by the time.
Well, you literally have the actors tied. I mean, they are screwed to the machine. So they are screwed. And so, you know, for example, when I was going to shoot Pac Rim, I made it a point when we were shooting the compa, the control room for the pilots. I watched a lot of movies that happened on like radio stations. Let's say talk radio, Oliver Stone, which is an incredibly kinetic movie of a guy sitting behind a desk, and I was trying to bounce off of that. Almost like a ping pong, saying, "Oh, he did this. Oh, he used a long lens. Oh, he used a dolly here," and say, "I can do my version of that." Obviously, I don't use the same tools, but I came up with the way of shooting the compa efficiently. After watching 4 or 5 movies, I said, "Oh, this is a good idea. What if we do this?" We did it with 2 hotheads on each side, on 2 cranes on each side, covering at the same time 45 degrees. That gave me the most flexibility than another pass on a bungee, blah, 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 blah. You know?
So what's your favorite part of it? Is it getting performances out of actors, or is it doing something that's technically different? Like you said, you know, finding a shot or trying a new shot, or like what's your favorite part?
Well, yeah, my favorite part is it depends on the genre of the movie. Like if it's Crimson Peak, is working with the actors, mm-hmm. and doing the scene again and again and finding the nuance and discovering and actors getting excited and so forth. If it's a movie that is driven by, and I don't mean digital effects or makeup effects, an effect, like a cinematic effect, I love finding that. Like, when the little girl hides in the alley in Pacific Rim, and we have all the cars and the set rigged on a hydraulic so that every time the kaiju takes a step, the whole set bounces, I kind of giggle at that. Like, I go, wow, the whole set just jumped.
Yeah.
You know, it depends. I think I enjoy most of my work. I mean, I enjoy my job, my day. I show up early because I can't wait to be there.
I would imagine that you, I don't know how anyone could direct a film if they didn't like directing, because it's, I mean, it literally is all of your energy for a long period of time, and yeah. you can't really, it's not like you hang your hat up at the end of a day and then like, well, I'm going to go home and forget about all that. Like it just doesn't stop.
No, I can't imagine it either. I mean, to me, it's not a date, it's a marriage. And I always say you can't fuck without a boner, right? you can't. And so, but a lot of people, if you are an itinerant director or you need to direct something by means of necessity, then you need to find the things in it that excite you.
Yeah.
You need to find what I think is the worst thing that can happen is when you have a job. It's your duty to find something that is exciting about it. I mean, I when I was a kid, I sold newspapers. I painted the highway lines one summer in Wichita, Kansas,
oh, wow.
with a machine, all those lines in the freeway,
yeah, just saw
the white line.
The movie Prince Avalanche. Well, what you guys
that, I did that over the summer. And there was always a factor that I go, like back then in the summer, I was 200 pounds lighter, and I said, well, I'm going to get a 6-pack and a 10. And I got both for the only time in my life. And so I said, but you have to find something that it doesn't matter. There's no job. If you're in a postal office or you're a waiter, whatever, you can find. Like I wrote most of the ideas about vampiric lore while I was working in a real estate office.
Really?
Previous to Kronos, yeah. I would get there at 7, open the how do you call it, the model home, and I would sit waiting for clients with the pamphlets. And I was reading and reading and reading and taking notes in my notebook all day long. A client showed up. I was happy to tend him because I was reading about the Strigoi in Eastern Europe. You know, as soon as they left, I went back from talking about the tiles.
That's
that
really fun. We're here to look at the house. Would you like to hear about my vampire lore? You know, we're going to go, we're good.
Have you heard about the penangling? Perhaps, you know?
So no, was that lore sort of where you drew for Blade 2?
Oh, yeah, for it's all interconnected because when we did Blade, the Reapers, and the way they were described before I came on board were completely different. They were described basically like the shapeshifters.
Okay.
Like John Carpenter's The Thing. Mm-hmm. Like they would grow a mouth in the arm and the arm would project and it would be like a tentacle and then another head would pop out of the shoulder. And I read it. First of all, I read it and then I talked to the studio and they told me the budget and I said, okay. So first of all, we can't afford it. Second of all, I have these ideas for vampires that could work, you know, and I brought a lot of the biology, the mouth, the transformation, blah, blah, blah. But the same were in Kronos. Originally I had a very small sort of a bee stinger under the tongue of Jesus Gris in Kronos after using the device that connected him to the insect in the Kronos device that he opened his mouth and he saw a little stinger come out from under his tongue. So, you know, these ideas have been there for ages.
Well, it seems like you like to put as much biology or even science, and just like, you know, with Packard, you're like, well, we wanted to make sure the physics of the Jaegers made sense and the kaiju made sense, as opposed to, you know, just let the special effects guys figure it out. You're like, you know, we really want to make sure that the biology works and the science is all solid.
It is, and in my case, when people say, oh, it's an effects this or an effects that, that's I'm directing that. Like we talked about this, I think last time is. I direct the animated scenes in Pac Rim with the same degree of precision and specificity that I would direct an actor and a cameraman, you know? You go, this is what I want, you're going to do this, this gesture is not right, let's change the angle, let's change the light, blah, blah, blah. But the main thing about what you were saying is I have this truly perverse fascination with how things work, and being biological or mechanical. I always say, Jim Cameron says there's not an autopsy that you don't like. You know, like almost every movie I do has an autopsy scene. True, but in my mind, when you see it, there's nothing more powerful in cryptozoology than when you find a dead animal. If you find that the carcass of a chupacabra or the carcass, it's because it was alive. So to me, the forensic aspect of this lends credibility to the creation of the creature.
Yeah.
You know, if the Jaegers get hit and a piece flies and you see all the pneumatic tubes and you see all the pistons that were pushing, it gives it an aura of credibility as opposed to what does it look like? I don't know. In the same way that I think when you were creating makeup effects, you needed to know anatomy. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to sever a neck and see a bunch of plastic refuse and a lot of red than to see the aorta or the veins or the trachea or, you know.
Yeah. So when you come off a movie like Pac Rim, is your first thought, I just want to direct like a small type of, you know, like a people drama with no effects?
Well, what happens is that I really just go to what you gravitate towards, you know. That's why I don't get involved with properties I'm absolutely passionate about. But what is exactly that you're going to direct, you don't really know. Like coming out of Pac Rim, I made it a point to say, okay, I've just made the largest movie I've done. Let me do The Strain, which is a tight budget, a tight schedule, and just do it. Because otherwise you get spoiled about, oh, I can only do it if you give me X amount of money. And the same is producing Mama or producing The Orphanage or Julia's Eyes. You do it for a number, and you just keep yourself jumping from one size to the other.
So when you're involved in a project like on a producerial level, like with The Strain, so what is your involvement at that point?
Well, specifically on The Strain, obviously I directed the pilot, co-wrote the pilot, dabbled on all the screenplays that you see in the series. I supervised every single VFX that you see in the entire series. I supervised and helped create the way we were going to execute every makeup effect in the whole series. I color time. I do the final color timing on all the episodes you're going to see in the series. People get amazed at how fast I react to dailies or edits. Like, you send me an edit, and about 2 hours after you send me the edit, you'll have all my notes.
Oh, wow.
I make it a point to do it that way. And dailies, next day, I visit the set, and I talk to the actors. Episodes I'm not director, I say, it was fantastic, that scene, great take on number 7. So I'm very involved because I feel that when I was a kid and I would read that somebody I liked did something, I would buy it expecting to find that that person was invested in that book or comic. Right. And it was very disappointing when you got the sense that that person had not done it.
They just put their name on
it. That they just put the name on it. Yeah. And I only one time I've produced a movie, a name to help the director, that was a Splice for Vincenzo Natali.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where I loved it. I said, just do whatever you want to do. We'll raise the money, but that's it. I didn't have to be involved from the moment we did the screenplay. The rest of the projects I produce in a very, very, very real way. It can go from screenplay, or it can go all the way to me being on the mixing stage or on the color correction suite with the directors and so forth.
So where do you find time to just watch things and enjoy them as a fan?
You know, I don't know, but I do. I mean, what I do is that if things don't hook me, I don't continue with them. In that sense, it's not that I'm impatient. I watch, everybody can love a show, and I see almost every pilot of everything that gets made. But if it doesn't grab me, I don't go to episode 2 or episode 3 unless it hooks me. So there are many, many series that the fans like that I have seen only one chapter or two off. And there are others that I've seen in their entirety.
Do you have to schedule time to do that, or do you just mash it in between everything else?
I watch, basically I watch a movie every day, for sure. And I watch at least one or two episodes of TV every day. I read comics very selectively. Like that, for example, I'm not up to speed. I'm up to speed with the Dark Universe of 54, the new 54 on DC. I'm up to speed with people that, fortunately for me, the guys I like are very slow. They are underground cartoonists, like Jim Woodring, Robert Crumb, Richard Corbin. They are not very prolific. They put a comic book every X number of months, and I can keep up with them. And the rest, I really, I'm completely ignorant about the general. I don't know who is the latest Iron Man or who is the latest foe of Green Lantern. I mean,
they're all winning now. That's what's happening.
Or zombies.
Yeah, yeah.
but you are select. You like go selectively. You can get into a funk and say, I'm gonna read. Like for example, familiar as you said with an obscure painter for a particular project, and you go into that track for a while.
Yeah. Was it you that told me that people were getting freaked out by the worm coming out of the eyeball with the strange...
On the billboard?
Yeah.
I see so many tweets of people just going, come on, I don't need to...
It's so visceral, just like right out of the white part of the bottom of the eyeball.
Yeah. Well, better than through the pupil.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah.
Well, you know, the reality is I find most other commercials more shocking. Beer commercials, the other commercials. Yeah. I find them much more morally... ambiguous for me, you know?
Yes, I would agree with you.
I think this is a truth in advertising.
Yeah.
You know, between a testosterone-oriented volleyball beer commercial or a worm in the eye, I'll take the worm.
Well, is that something that you oversaw in terms of...
No. No, campaigns, most of the time, campaigns don't go through directors. You know, how you make your movie, what movie you make, and what movie they sell. If you are blessed with the fact that the marketing people are selling the same movie you made, it's great. But sometimes you see that they're selling a different movie than you made. And you are basically, you know, you can, unless you are a 800-pound gorilla that can slam the fist and say, you're going to sell it the way I see it, it's... you kind of do what you can.
And if that does happen, are you able to write it off, or do you?
No, it's painful when that happens. It's painful when that happens as director. It's painful when that happens as producer. I mean, I don't think you can see with indifference the flaming of 2 years of your life or 3 years of your life or more with any patience. You know, I don't live to generate a daily content or a weekly content. I basically am living to generate little milestones of my life, you know, and you cannot see, oh, there goes my 15th anniversary. I mean, you simply cannot be at ease with that, but you need to know how much you can do and who is your partner, you know?
That's why it would draw that. But besides the fact that I don't think I could direct anything ever, the fact that you have to rely on so many different people and people that you don't know to handle the thing that you made and also present it to people in a certain way like that, I wouldn't be able to deal with that part of it.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. And when you see, you know, when you see a good movie that goes ignored, or that, for example, when you produce in Europe, I do produce in Europe, a movie that I like a lot, like Julia's Eyes, and then it gets released so tiny in America, tiny, like literally same day on VOD, or, you know,
right.
And it pains me because you say, well, this movie, but eventually, I think in my experience, eventually the movies used to, I don't know if that's true anymore, they used to find their audience. Like a movie of mine that was unleashed in 13 theaters when it came out in America was Devil's Backbone. Mm-hmm. Still one of my favorite movies I've done. And eventually it finds its audience.
I think definitely. I mean, I think it finds its audience better now than it did, you know, 15 years ago. Because,
yeah.
I mean, but I went to, you know, I went, I was the other night, I just wanted to watch a random horror movie just for no reason other than I just want to watch a horror movie. And I went on to the iTunes horror page and I was like, what the fuck are any of these? Like, I didn't recognize, like, there's this whole just, like, glut of, you know, kind of low-budge horror movies.
There always has been.
No, I know, but now, like, I mean, I literally didn't recognize.
Now he has access to them, which he didn't
before. Yeah.
I didn't recognize any of them. Like, I have no idea.
What is funny is that just as there were a glut, some glut of super cheap gore, super hardcore, brutal B movie, and now there are some. And there's a glut of B mumblecore horror. There's a glut of zombie. There's a glut. There is just different types of glut. But out of those things, some interesting stuff comes out. You know, and I try to watch as much as I can of those. Same thing, 10, 15 minutes. It gets me. I watch it all the way. And I watched. That's how I found sometimes directors that I want to produce or that I want to see what they direct next, or, you know, it's really good. Yeah,
that's a really great. I never thought about it. For some reason, I always just think if I sit down to watch this, I have to watch the whole thing. It honestly never occurred to me that I could just turn it off after 15 minutes, because I always feel like, no, if I watch this, I got to stick it out. Like, I'm a person that will stick something out until the very end in hopes that it will pay off. And a lot of times it doesn't always pay off. And so I go, well, I don't have time.
Well, you can do it. You can certainly do it also. But if you're taking a shoot at something that you don't know if it's good or not, you know, you don't watch like that when it's a filmmaker you know to some degree. Like you say, well, this filmmaker, I like the first movie. You stick to it until the end. But if you're literally seeing it for the first time, you can take that. If there's something interesting, there was Alec Baldwin said to me a term that I love. He says, there are some movies that are one sock movies. So what do you mean? He says, you're going out, you're putting your socks on, you have one sock in, one sock on your hand, and you stop and you say, honey, I'm on my way, just let me watch a little more. there are some of those in the B movie realm that you end up enjoying, you know, and discovering. I've found 10, 15 movies in horror through just random stumbling onto them, you know?
It's funny. I remember, like, you know, going to the video store and, you know, like, you go, the horror sections were always the biggest sections out of any video store, and just, you know, tape after tape, and you would always just go based off of the artwork, which, like, in the, you know, 80s slasher and horror stuff, never seemed to have anything to do. It's like they just found a really cool artist. And like, and this movie's kind of about, like, a monster guy. They're like, oh, yeah, I got it. And then you just go watch it, and you see a movie like Judgment Night, which isn't the one, not the one with Emilio Estevez, but there's a There's another one that I can't find. I can't find. I've been looking for it for years, but it's called Judgment Night. These two guys in South America that come across the town of Santana right when it happens to be the night that hell visits every year.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's, and you've not been able to find it since.
Haven't been able to find it since.
Have you asked the internet? Up,
were right? were you under the effects of any hallucinogenic?
No. I was a kid. I was like, I dosed by my parents.
You think you have the name wrong, maybe?
Could be. But I've like put in like the synopsis. I can't find it.
That happened to me with a novel that I thought I heard Stephen King recommend one day, and I can't find it. It's a novel called Asylum, and it was probably by the wrong writer. I was writing everything he was saying, and I haven't been able to find it.
No.
I found three or four asylums, but they're not the one.
Just call him and ask him.
You know. Hey, you remember that interview in the... Yeah.
Yes, I do. I remember it all.
Are you able to watch as just a layperson, or do you watch... Are you watching as a director when you're watching a movie?
Well, the worst time to watch any movie is when you're shooting, because then you notice everything.
Sure.
You know, you go, oh, they caught, oh, they're using a 27. Oh, you know, you notice everything. But when you're not shooting, yes, you can get enraptured by a movie like anybody else, you know.
What do you think a movie should, like if, you know, as an audience member, I'm going to see a movie, like, What do you think is the ideal takeaway? Like, what do you think? What do you want people to take away from a film?
Well, you know, that's hard to answer. In the short term, obviously, you want people to have a scene, a moment, or the entirety of the movie that they take with them and they say, this was fantastic. But some movies grow into you. You know, like a lot of the movies I grow to love, I hated the first time I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I thought, what a terrible movie. Yeah. But they stay with you, and then you find yourself thinking about them, mm-hmm. and you revisit them, and you go... So sometimes that, especially in the genre, in horror, mm-hmm. you know, and that's my... I will not name which movies specifically, because each one has their own taste in horror, but you can see a horrible, terrible horror movie with two or three moments that are just great.
Yeah.
And then you go back and eventually you get into the groove and, you know, the movies change with you.
Yeah, and also sometimes movies have to, like, you know, you bring, like, your own shit to a movie,
yeah.
but, like, sometimes a movie's got to teach you how to watch it.
Yes.
It's like, and you have to be ready for the rhythm and the style that the movie's going to give you, as opposed to, like, you know, you expecting the movie to be a certain way. Like,
yeah.
that one movie, Adventureland, which was, like, the trailer, what I thought the movie was going to be was this kind of, like, summer comedy about these people working at a shitty amusement park. Mm-hmm. But it's like it actually turns out it's like a coming-of-age, like, a dramedy. With like a lot of serious tones, and I didn't realize that till like halfway through. The whole time that I'm watching the movie, going like, it's like, man, all these jokes are falling pretty flat.
Mm. Yes. Well, that's why in some movies you get second, third, fourth time. I mean, even if you sometimes you can catch them with one sock in your hand for the third time, and you get them just then. You know, it's quite fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, music is kind of like that too.
I just had that with Boyhood.
Yeah.
Where I watched it and I was like, nothing happened. You know, like I watched it.
Yeah.
And the movie is structured in such a way that, I think I may have told you this, Jonah, but
yeah.
you have no idea when the movie's going to end, because there's no like traditional act structure in
anyway.
It. It's like, well, this could go on. Like, we could follow this kid to 40. Like, I have no idea where it's going to wrap
That's
up.
A sequel.
And then it just ends. And when I watched it, I was like, man, nothing really happened, but I thought about it for like 4 days after I saw the movie, just like replaying it in my head. So
yeah.
Does that mean that I loved the movie or that it affected me? And, you know, like it just,
well,
I couldn't stop thinking of, no, I know,
yeah.
but I mean, I, you know, it was not, when I left, I was like, I don't know what I was supposed to take away from that. And yet I thought about it for like 4 days
yeah.
afterwards.
I remember, I mean, it happened to me early on with the Coens. Where I would come out of the movie and go, oh, I don't know, like Barton Fink.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I saw it and I thought, ah, it's very obscure, very arcane. Then I worked with Miramax and I understood the entire movie. I came back and I go, I love it, and I know those guys. And it's one of my favorite movies of them. It happens with movies that play by their own rules, and marketing, word of mouth, whatever it is, makes you expect something else. Like the people that came to me saying, I thought Pan's Labyrinth was a fantasy, and I hated it because you had violence. I go, all right, now, but now that you know it has violence, maybe watch it again. Yeah. You know, sometimes you people need the movie to speak in their own in its own terms,
yeah.
And you discover it a second time.
Exactly, like kind of, you know, the Kids in the Hall movie, Brain Candy. You know, mm-hmm. when I was going to see that movie, I wasn't expecting like a really artfully done.
You're expecting like yeah. You're expecting more like sketches and comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like, and then I didn't really like it when I saw it. And then like but you know, you kind of also experiences in your own life. Or just like when you become more aware of you know, film in general, then you understand movies better. Like, you know, like watching a romantic comedy about like maybe like a couple trying to work it out. As a kid, you don't get it. You're laughing at it. You kind of get it, but then you actually start going through those experiences, and you can actually go back to movies yeah. with an understanding of how, you know, the world works a little better. That's another thing. Like, I've gone back to movies I thought were just okay, and now I'm like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah, War of the Roses probably wasn't a great movie for 12-year-olds.
But I remember loving it.
I love that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that movie. But you know, like you have also, with horror, it happens with people like Fulci. You know, like a lot of people, the more you watch Fulci, for example, the more you appreciate things that he does again and again and again, or his touch, and you get to acquire that taste, and then you're like, you have a vice for,
yeah.
you have a proclivity for Fulci, and then you adore him, and then you can defend, not only like him, but defend him articulately to someone and say, look, the guy is completely cohesive in what he does.
Yeah, that's very true. Like when people say best stuff about you know, Romero. Mm-hmm. Like it's like they, like, you know, when Land of the Dead came out and people were like, they're, you know, they're using guns, they're using tools, and like, you know, the zombies are, you know, they're, you're like, well, you know, the first movie, Night of the Living Dead, like the first zombie you see picks up a rock to smash a window in.
Window.
It's like he set up all that stuff.
Plus that's like getting angry with Henry Ford because he didn't put an FM radio. I mean, he invented the goddamn thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Know? Yeah.
He invented the fake thing.
Yeah.
he invented zombies.
Yeah, yeah.
The way,
so
we know them.
You sort of...
Ghouls, yeah. But it is kind of funny that an audience will take ownership over something yeah. that is beyond you and go... I mean, you see, like, I think George Lucas is the perfect example of the guy who completely lost the thing that he created to the world. And they're like, you can't do that. And he's like, I fucking made it up. I can probably do whatever I want. You didn't make it up. I made it up.
You don't know these people.
Yeah. Well, I did for the extended universe. Like, yeah, but I did, you know. A lot of this came from up here. Right there.
Sorry I didn't know what you wrote down in your diary as a kid. Sorry I didn't make that one.
That happens with very rare movies that then become... part of the culture, you know?
Right?
And then they become part of the culture as much as they could be yours.
But I think that also, you know, as frustrating as it might be as the creator, that it's probably you do have to recognize, like, oh, I think I made something special. Like, if someone wants to take ownership over something and tell you how it is, then it obviously affected them in a certain
yeah.
way,
yeah.
and so ultimately you did your job.
Yeah, and movies, people think that they exist. More objectively than a book, let's say, but they are not. Any person reading a book has a version of the book that is different from yours, and the same happened with a movie. Just because they are consolidated images and sound doesn't mean that their dialogue with you is not equally personal. Like the movie that you hate for these reasons are the movies that I love for those exact
right,
reasons.
Yeah.
So they're incredibly personal. I've come to believe that you can't argue. You can argue technically, but you cannot argue the merits of a movie any more than you can defend one religion over the other. That religion is kooky, really? Tell me what your religion is composed of. Tell me the basic tenets of your religion.
Well, you see, Zeno
let's see if it's
came
right.
down.
Yeah. Yes. But, or somebody floated over water. I mean, ultimately, the components of a religion may sound crazy to you. But that sounds perfectly.
Have you ever come out of a project and changed your idea of what you thought it was that it meant? Like, have you kind of go in with an idea like, oh, I'm making this kind of a story, and then when you see it, you go, oh no, actually, I think I was making this, and I guess I didn't realize it at the time.
Well, it happens during the shoot, very very pointedly. You know, you during the shoot, you start seeing what happens, and then you start changing and accommodating things that you didn't see originally. I mean, that's part of the fun. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I don't think you land way on the other side of a mark. You land within degrees of a mark. I don't think you go, it ended up being a musical or something.
You know? I don't know what happened.
No, yeah.
All of a sudden, the Jaegers just started dancing. It doesn't make any sense.
It just looked cool.
I know. Well, there is. I always kind of wonder. Sometimes when I feel like I try to over-engineer things, like I really want it to mean this, or I really want this joke to mean this, it's usually a lot better if I go, fuck it, this is just a fun thing to do, you know, as opposed to trying to micromanage how the audience is going to take it.
Well, there is that. That's the thing with film. There is such an enthronement of the myth of the all-controlling entity. I mean, the guy that most embodies that is Kubrick, you know, and then when you really listen, talk, meet, or read about the closest collaborators he had, you still see that he was struggling with what he wanted and what was offered to him by chance. And sometimes he could find the take by doing it 95 times and then saying, that's what I wanted. Or sometimes, you know, he was at the mercy of an explosion gone wrong. And I always quote this anecdote of Kirk Douglas hurt himself while they were shooting either Paths of Glory or Spartacus. And Kubrick sent him a little message saying, could you stay down another week or two? I'm figuring out the movie. Oh, and this is the man that most embodies the myth of the ever all-knowing creator. And the more you work on it, the more you find out that movies have speak to the people doing them, and the unexpected is a real force in the way movies get shaped at the end of the day.
So what's kind of your favorite unexpected thing that happened that ended up becoming like, oh, this was a...
Well, again, going to Devil's Backbone, which is one of the movies I love the most, for me, one of the things I love is the ending. The very ending was supposed to continue for another 2-3 minutes, and it was supposed to go on to 4 or 5 more shots. It was the end of the day, the worst day of the shoot. I had shot that in the afternoon after lunch. I had shot Jacinto, the bad guy, stabbing the girl. Now we had run, and we were shooting the ending. And that morning we had shot another part of the explosion. So it was a crazy, crazy day. And I saw the shot, the single shot that is in the movie, which is the kids walking away and the silhouette of the professor against the landscape. And I just turned to Navarro, to Guillermo, the cinematographer, and I said, that's it. That's the end. We don't have to shoot all the other stuff, all the other dialogue, all the other points of view. That's it.
Do you think that was fatigue, maybe?
No. You have a clarity. Like another thing that happened on that movie is the bomb, when it falls on the ground, it was meant to stay vertical, but the cable snapped and it started going sideways. And I fortunately had shot it in a way that allowed me to keep it that way. And then we made it incline. In the next shot that we did, we put a hydraulic, made it go sideways, and that became a better image. Huh. You know, you never know. Yeah,
so why was that? What particularly about that film was, why was that your favorite?
It's not my only favorite. Like, right now, I'm crazy in love with Crimson Peak, Pan's Labyrinth, that one. And crazy enough, Pacific Rim. You know, I'm mad in love with those. But what happened is I consider Devil's Backbone my first movie, because Kronos is what I could do with the first time at the bat. You know, I see only the things that I didn't do well, blah, blah, blah. Mimic was such a difficult experience that I didn't get to enjoy it, you know. And then Devil's Backbone was the first time I felt I was in control, and I had enough craftsmanship, if you would, to tell the story the way I wanted. So it became, to me, it was my first movie.
And before that, was it just that you felt like you lacked the influence with the studios you were working with?
No. Like in Kronos, there was no studio. It's just is like trying to sketch a beautiful painting with a train chasing you down the track. Mm-hmm. You know, right behind you. It's really And the more you do it, the calmer you know. You know the tools. You can find a solution to every problem. You can talk your way with an actor, with a cameraman, finding a staging that works. And you know, on the third movie, I felt I had enough control to be able to deliver the movie I thought needed to be delivered.
So what is it that, because we're getting kind of close. What do you want to promote now? Like, what do you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm happy. I mean, we can talk about anything. I mean, The Strain, I'm happy, is going great, and Crimson Peak coming up. I don't know.
Crimson Peak, yeah. I think I see a question from the back.
Oh, Book of Life.
Book
All
of
right.
Life, everybody. Book of Life.
Yeah, coming out in October, and a beautiful animated movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Book of Life looks gorgeous.
Yeah, it is.
That's gorgeous. All the, like, the Dia de los Muertos.
Yes.
Oh, it's so stunning. I saw that the trailer.
It is, and that's why we all, I mean, we've been working on it for now 5 years or six years.
Oh, my God.
And,
well, no wonder you forgot it was coming
out. No, it's I mean, I was just chatting. You know, I was having a good time. But no, it's coming out. It's gorgeous. It's really quite unique. I think it's a slice of Mexico in a way. Musically, fantastic music. Visually, amazing journey to a palette of colors, shapes that is so profoundly linked to who we are, Jorge, the director, and myself as Mexicans. You know, it is so intrinsic to who we are in the world that it was great to be able to express it by supporting Jorge. It's his first film. I gravitate a lot to producing first-time directors, and that's why I watch all these strange movies.
Yeah.
And because I think, and I watch a lot of shorts, and when somebody gives me a short, I make it a point to try and watch it and write back. Sometimes I fall behind, but I try to do it. And with Jorge, is the fact that you're discovering a new type of voice. Like, this movie doesn't look like every other talking animal CGI animated movie out there. It has a real personality visually, orally, with the music and so forth. And it's great to help usher those things into the world. You know?
Yeah, you should look up Book of Life, because the trailer is stunning.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
What is there about Mexican culture that you feel like that America doesn't really understand? Are there things about Mexican culture that you would want people here to know, or how do we get it wrong?
Well, I mean, I think that we all have a blind side to some form of the culture, you know, of every culture. Like, it's just the complexity of Mexico is so great. The food is, for example, is so complex. You know, it goes way beyond what you normally associate with fast Mexican food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the music is the same way. The
culture. Why go beyond that? You perfected food with chili relleno. There's no need.
It is.
We don't have to go past that.
It is. It's the dish and the plate at the same time. No, it's like you don't need a plate for that. But the same thing is true of music, you know. And one thing that I love about Book of Life is that it has the complexity of what Mexico is, not was, is. We live in a country that is as much shaped by our tradition and our roots as it was by Bruce Lee movies, mm-hmm. or punk or ska. And Book of Life has a fusion of everything that has made us, I think, who we are as a culture. And it's an incredibly, it's not a piece of folklore. It's a piece of living art. And that's why, because you get this folkloric idea of Mexico, and then you find the country's shockingly modern, shockingly vital, and, you know, has many more facets to it than you imagine at first.
How often do you get to go home?
I go less now than I used to because of the kidnappings, you know, and my dad was kidnapped in 98. So after...
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, we free him after 72 days.
Oh, my God.
And you know, after that, there's a real concern.
Yeah.
When I go back, there's some people that kidnap him that are still at loose.
Ugh.
And, you know, you don't take it lightly.
No.
You have to go there with precautions and this and that, which is a shame, because it's the thing of me that I think died a little after my dad kidnapping. I wanted to make stories that were very rooted in Mexico as director and you know, a Spanish intellectual saw Devil's Bargain, and he said, you realize it's a Mexican movie. And I go, yeah, you know, it's more Mexican than Spanish. I said, yeah, I understand the aesthetics and the passion and this and that. But it's because something was robbed of me when my dad was kidnapped. And we got him back, but so I'm thankful. But I lost a part of who I am or was that I don't think I'll ever get back.
Was it ever a story that you thought you wanted to tell?
No, you know, there is a particular story that I learned during the kidnapping of my father. It was told to me by one of the negotiators, because we went through three negotiators in 72 days, and that I someday want to write as a short story, because it's an incredibly shocking tale. But other than that, what is tragic is, I think the best portrayal of a kidnapping is the sort of tragic comedy on Fargo.
Right.
Yeah, you know, because it's so pregnant with sort of crappy everyday things. You know, you go, they say, we need to record the kidnapping, the calls. And I go and I go to a Radio Shack. And then the woman at the Radio Shack is in no hurry to sell me the recorder. And she goes, how much is the RC-55? And in the meantime, I'm crapping in my pants because they're calling in 2 minutes.
Right.
The guys are calling to negotiate in 2 minutes. And I go like, take the money, give me the thing. Things like, I mean, there are so many anecdotes during the kidnapping. But ultimately, I'm not objective enough to either talk about it. It's something that didn't happen to me. It happened to my brother, my sister, my mother, my father. And I find it profoundly affecting. And I don't want to touch into something that touches so many people's spirit and soul.
Right. It's very close.
It's too close. And I still like seeing my family and being in speaking terms with them.
Okay, I guess enough time hadn't passed then all these years.
No, but it really there are the little things that you learn that you go, it's a slap to the forehead.
Yeah,
the things that the real kidnappings, like we would get the ransom notes, and you know the there are many syntax and spelling errors.
Yeah,
and you're affected by it. I cannot explain to you how. I can only tell you it does affect you. You realize there's a person on the other side. These are not cute, cut letters pasted in perfect ransom, Hollywood movie way. This is somebody that somewhat didn't know how to read or write correctly. And that affects you if you have enough of a sensibility for it, you know? And it's pregnant with the real world, the kidnapping, where you go, That's kind of sad, but at the same time, so real.
Well, yeah, because you used to, you know, if you don't have any experience with that, obviously the only experience that you have are seeing, you know, one-dimensional representations of things. Yeah. Like, oh, this must be what a kidnapping is like.
You take the E from People magazine.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but you know, the funny thing is one of the most realistic representations of kidnapping, because most of the negotiators in the big kidnappings in Latin America come from England. They come from a firm that specializes on that, and one of the most real is a proof of life. Until Russell Crowe falls in love with Meg Ryan, then nothing's real. And after that, truly,
Meg's career.
It becomes a rom-com drama. Yeah. Whatever it becomes, it's not real. But the first part is exactly how it happens. You call a negotiator, the negotiator shows up, gives you the ground rules. He tells you this is what you can do and you cannot do, and you're not going to argue any of this with me. You are so ill-prepared for a kidnapping. You think you did the right thing on the first phone call, you did the wrong thing. Mm. You think your impulse, what you are raised to believe is what you should do, and you're advised to do exactly the opposite. Like, you know, it's so shocking. Yeah.
Well, I think it goes without saying that I'm glad everything worked out okay.
Yeah, I did. I mean, again, what you lose, I can complain about losing this, losing that. What we were able to preserve, which is my dad, his life, ultimately the family, in whatever form it survives, I'm eternally grateful. I can't complain about the things I lost. This was, the winner was him walking in the door, you know, after 72 days.
So what is as we're kind of wrapping down here? Is it what are you up to this week? Are you working on?
Well, we are promoting the strain. You know, we are in the second chapter, in the second episode. We are starting to discuss the possibility of where we would go on a second season, breaking down the book, having meetings with the writers and so forth, awaiting a decision on that. I'm at the same time prepping a very small movie, and in 3 weeks, at the same time, in 3 weeks, we open the first day of 9 months of design for Pacific Rim 2. Because it takes 9 months to design a movie like that. So you go, you open that room, you start pre-production here, we're finishing our first-time director movie in Mexico, many, many things.
Wow. Do you still go to bed at night or wake up in the morning and say, I can't believe I get to do all the shit that I get to do?
I don't know how. See, the thing that I find shocking, I bless the fact that this is my line of work and this is what I do for a living. I wake up when I see my monsters around me in my office and so forth. But what is really mind-boggling to me is that whatever you know I do, the novels, the books, the TV, blah, 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 I do without an office. It's me.
Oh, wow.
It's like me, Ian, my personal assistant, and that's it. Like, I don't have a staff. I don't have 30 people. It's me. So that I still don't know. There's like a quantum physics equation that I discovered in the Chile Relleno. Allows me to do all these things because I do them. I really do them, and I don't know. I still don't know how. And there's a great story to finish, where Mexico, the city of Mexico, which now has 20 something million people, in the 1980s, the president called urban designers from all over the world to analyze the city. And they came, they looked at the traffic, they looked at the statistics, the census, the number of cars, and they said, look, we want to tell you one thing. We looked at the model, and in paper, it shouldn't work. So however it's working, don't touch it. And I feel that's my professional life.
Well, it's always great to see you.
Same here, man.
Please come back anytime you want.
We will.
And I'm excited about... I'm excited they're working on Pac Rim 2, but I'm also I'm so excited for Book of Life. I can't even tell.
Yeah, October.
Are you going to be at Comic Con at all?
Yeah. No, I'm going there. I'm gonna go, hopefully with a very discreet disguise.
To go on
the floor.
See me out there, just yell Chile Relleno.
Yeah, Chile Relleno. Yeah. Well, if you see me out there and you identify me, tell me so I can get a better disguise. Yeah. I'm going there with like a farmer in a tractor show with a sweaty wad of bills to buy stuff in cash. You know,
get there early because preview night's real crowded now.
Oh, I'll be there with a mask.
I gotta go to preview. I want that Porkins.
Yep.
You're going to get the Porkins. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Porkins.
The giant Porkins bust.
Yeah.
I got to get that.
Yeah,
that's really right. Baddest guy in Star Wars. Come on.
Who made
that guy? Gentle Giant, I think.
Oh, okay, cool.
Excellent.
A cool company.
Enjoy Comic-Con if you're going, and enjoy your burrito, everyone.
And Chile Relleno.
And Chile Relleno. Enjoy your Chile Relleno.
Wrap that in a burrito. Have a good time. You're welcome.
Oh, I'm mad at that.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels...
There are murders in all of the books.
...that she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.